Bligh, devastated by this most personal of mutinies, sailed home without his beloved daughter. He was accompanied by Atkins, Patterson, and many other powerful men of the colony, as well as the soldiers of the corps that had deposed him. This made for strained after-dinner conversations during the five-month voyage. The British didn't know what to do with Bligh, so they made him an admiral. The most divisive character in Australia's short history drew his last breath in 1817, a complete and utter bastard to the end. The scum also rises. The officers of the corps had been the administrative backbone of the colony. Their departure left a vacuum that the Black Watch couldn't fill. This meant that the new governor was forced to make appointments that his predecessors would have considered distasteful. Darcy Wentworth was the greatest beneficiary of this new order. Macquarie confirmed Darcy's appointment as the colony's principal surgeon and made him a justice of the peace, magistrate, member of the governor's court, commissioner of police, treasurer of the police fund, and turnpike commissioner. Macquarie's first big public works project was the Sydney to Parramatta Turnpike, or toll road. He was the first New South Wales governor to believe in infrastructure, but he also believed in other people paying for it. Tolls were a typical Scots solution. Darcy Wentworth had more hats than a geriatric milliner, but he also had a checkered past. Darcy was born of noble stock, a distant cousin to Charles Watson Wentworth, a two-time British Prime Minister, whose nephew Earl Fitzwilliam sponsored Darcy's entree into London society. But Darcy was the son of a publican from the stunted Irish branch of the Wentworth family tree, and his surgeon's income prevented him from keeping up with the St John's. Determined to maintain a gentleman's lifestyle, Darcy took on a second job and became Britain's most notorious surgeon highwayman. Being a surgeon didn't carry the same cachet it does now. Surgeons doubled as barbers until 1745, and by Darcy's time were regarded as little more than hairdressers with ambition and extra-large scissors. Darcy was charged with four armed robberies between 1787 and 1789. On one occasion, he was caught carrying a pistol and black silk mask near the scene of a hold-up. On another, he left a stolen watch in court. Slips of this kind normally guaranteed the noose, but Darcy's Irish charm and family connections resulted in a series of stunning acquittals. The Times' regular articles on the escapades of the famous Darcy Wentworth mortified Fitzwilliam, who encouraged his kinsman to book a ticket to Sydney before a judge did it for him. Darcy, who emigrated with the Second Fleet, was the first of many black sheep sent to Australia by embarrassed relatives. Darcy worked as a doctor and convict supervisor, but Fitzwilliam's grudging assistance enabled him to start an import business and buy up farmland. The amiable surgeon was soon one of the wealthiest men in the colony. He was well-liked, but his colourful history meant he would never be entirely trusted by the colony's elite. Macquarie, however, trusted Darcy absolutely. He believed that a man should not be judged for his past actions, but for his recent conduct. He also believed that a man should not be judged when he is responsible for regularly cauterising one's recurring genital ulcers with a red-hot wire. Darcy was not the only of Macquarie's appointments to raise eyebrows. The madman was giving plum jobs to ex-convicts. Simeon Lord and Andrew Thompson, one-time cloth thieves, were appointed turnpike commissioners alongside Darcy and, to the settlers' horror, were elevated to the magistracy, where they passed judgment on those for whom they had previously laboured. Later, Macquarie explained his approach to ex-convicts known as emancipists thus:
"My principle is that when once a man is free, his former state should no longer be remembered or allowed to act against him."
Macquarie's critics, however, believed that the convict stain could never be washed away. As far as they were concerned, the inmates were taking over the asylum. Currency lads. Macquarie also provided opportunities to those born within the colony. Most of his countrymen regarded the native-born as the depraved spawn of criminal degenerates, prone to idleness, compulsive drinking, and poor personal hygiene. The native-born were actually far healthier than their British counterparts, having enjoyed a childhood free of being stuffed up chimneys or down coal mines. They enjoyed full employment and shorter working hours than British labourers, and even when food was scarce, never had to resort to dead rats, bark or lumps of coal, those staples of working-class English cuisine. The first colonial teenagers rejected their parents' values, as teenagers have done ever since Cain and Abel decided to get away from all that hippie nature stuff. They were sober, industrious, and, if truth be told, not much fun. They laboured uncomplainingly in the sun, exercised in the fresh air, swam in the sea, and were, on average, 6 inches taller than the malnourished British stock from which they had sprung. Within a single generation, the Artful Dodger had transformed into Chesty Bond. Even so, most of these mild colonial boys were convinced of their inferiority. Young Hamilton Hume, a Parramatta-born protégé of Macquarie, expressed hope that he might one day be trusted to do some exploring, although an Australian. The first generation of Nouveau Australians had chips on their shoulders, and what's more, they believed British chips were better. They had just invented the cultural cringe. The native-born were known as currency after the banknotes that lacked the intrinsic value of the sterling, the pound of silver that served as the British monetary standard and lent its name to the British-born colonists. Macquarie's inner Scot was thrilled to have arrived in a land where the people named themselves after money. While many native-born wore the currency tag with a sense of shame, a few, like William Charles Wentworth, adopted it as a badge of honour. William was the eldest son of Catherine Crowley, Darcy's 17-year-old convict mistress. The timing of his birth suggests that he was the product of a pre-Darcy dalliance, but Darcy adopted William upon Catherine's untimely death and sent him to England for a classical education. Keen-minded but lazy, William spent his school days writing poetry, drinking port, and blowing his allowance on lottery tickets. He was unable to get a job in England, which he attributed to anti-colonial prejudice, and others attributed to his being an insufferable smartass. Dispirited, he returned to the colony with no skills beyond being able to order a drink and place a bet in Latin, ancient Greek, and haiku. William was a lump of a lad, with coarse features and an unkempt shock of ginger hair. His dishevelled look was complemented by a cast eye that stared disconcertingly over the shoulder of whomever he happened to be shouting at. William was an enthusiastic shouter, with a voice like treacle being poured down a foghorn. He would use this formidable instrument to harangue any person foolish enough to disagree with him, concluding each outburst by saying something incomprehensible, although obviously very clever, in Latin, or by delivering a withering put-down in flawless iambic pentameter. Macquarie was impressed by William's shouting skills and appointed him acting provost marshal, placing him in charge of the colony's public meetings and hanging roster. William, the first native born to be appointed to a senior position in the colony, would devote his life to cutting Australia loose from the apron strings of Mother Britain. There's something about Mary. Macquarie also encouraged women to participate in public life, starting in his own home. Elizabeth Macquarie oversaw the transformation of Sydney's rugged domain into sculptured parkland, with the Harbour View sandstone bench she commissioned still known as Mrs. Macquarie's Chair. She also introduced haymaking to the colony and was a director of the Bank of New South Wales. Australian women had opportunities beyond those afforded to their British sisters. This was, in large part, a product of the law of supply and demand. Women were in short supply and high demand, enabling them to negotiate a better life for themselves. They were able to choose from an increasingly desperate lineup of prospective suitors and, if a partner didn't come up to scratch, he could be traded in for a better and wealthier model. Back in the old Dart, everything a woman owned passed to her husband upon marriage. In the colony, a convict couldn't own land or trading licences, so, where a free woman was married to a convict, she owned all such property. Convict men were also commonly assigned as servants to their free wives. If a man in such a situation stayed out late with his mates or forgot to put the privy seat down, the missus could discharge him from her service and send him to the chain gang. Men on the frontier also sometimes returned to Britain, leaving their wives or mistresses in charge of their Australian affairs. Elizabeth MacArthur, for example, took on the family's pastoral concerns in John's absence. A dead or absent partner and a dearth of local male relatives often conspired to leave substantial business interests in the hands of colonial women. Of course, colonial women still did it pretty tough. In 1811, a Sydney man was lashed for putting a halter around his wife's neck and selling her at market for £16. But on the bright side, a wife seller in Britain might escape punishment altogether, and the market value of a second-hand spouse was considerably less. The Times later reported that a man took his halted wife to Axbridge Market and sold her for a shilling. The Sydney spouse was worth an incredible 320 times the value of her English counterpart. Australian women should be proud of this difference in the used wife exchange rate. Things were definitely looking up for Australian women. Nobody embodies female colonial opportunity more than Mary Reeby. The po-faced grandmother on our $20 note was Australia's first cross-dressing, horse-thieving, seal-clubbing, convict entrepreneur and standover woman. 13-year-old Mary was a middle-class girl who was, as the English would say, high-spirited, and as we Australians would say, a little shit. She eloped with another girl, dressed as a boy, assumed the names James Burrow, stole a horse and was sentenced to death. James went through the courts and spent months in a crowded cell without anyone realising he was a she. After the sentence was commuted, her gender was revealed during the compulsory pre-transportation bath and an appeal was lodged for her pardon. The appeal fell on deaf ears. Magistrated hated drag kings even more than they hated horse thieves, and Mary was lucky to escape to New South Wales with her life. British magistrates ordered a number of women executed for impersonating men, in accordance with Deuteronomy 22:5. The woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment, for all that do so are abomination unto the Lord thy God. The sexist British legal system did not similarly punish cross-dressing men, much to the relief of Scotsmen and generations of Tory MPs. At age 17, Mary married Thomas Reeby, a junior East India Company officer. When Thomas died young, Mary inherited his extensive pastoral, hotel, shipping and sealing concerns. She expanded her empire through canny investments and a single-mindedly vicious approach to anyone who owed her money, all the while caring for seven children. Despite being convicted of beating a debtor like he was her red-headed stepson, Mary remained a Macquarie favourite and prospered under his rule, helping him establish the Bank of New South Wales and leasing him her house to serve as its first branch. Macquarie's willingness to work with black sheep, ex-cons, the native-born, women and other undesirables has led to him being viewed as a champion of Australian democracy, a notion that would have made him furious. Macquarie wrote of his implacable hatred of the infernal and destructive principles of democracy, which he believed to be decadently Greek, unfashionably French, and dangerously American. Macquarie didn't have a democratic bone in his body. He was an equal opportunity autocrat who didn't mind who you were, what you'd done, or whom you'd done it to, as long as you obeyed his commands and didn't cost him money. Ah, money. That was still proving to be a bit of a problem. Chapter 10. I think I'll call it Macquarie. Or maybe Lachlan. Lachlan's a good name too. Governor Lachlan Macquarie, every year between 1810 and 1821. The Holy Dollar. Rum was still the colony's favoured currency when Lachlan Macquarie was decanted from his vessel after the seven-month journey from Portsmouth. Lord Castlereagh, the colonial secretary, had ordered the new governor to prohibit the use of spirituous liquors, but he may as well have told the notoriously tight Scot to burn thousands of pounds and sprinkle the ashes in Botany Bay. Rum was both an alcoholic drink and money, which were Macquarie's two favourite things. There was no way he'd be getting rid of it. Instead, he distributed lucrative liquor licence to his allies and recommended that Britain approve the unlimited importation of alcohol, with a steep rise in import duties. This would fill his coffers while buying the continued loyalty of his supporters. Meanwhile, convicts were dying in an inefficient and disorderly manner. They were dying in their homes. They were dying in the fields. They were dying in pubs, shops, churches and alleyways. The only place they weren't dying was the hospital. This was not the hospital's fault. It was an absolute death trap, complete with termite-infested walls, streams of raw sewage and heavily tattooed male nurses whose bedside manners would have been called into question if the hospital had had any beds. Macquarie, who had spent much of his life having unpleasant things done to his spine region, was a firm believer in quality healthcare. He wanted to build a hospital that people would be happy to be seen dead in, but simply couldn't afford it. Then one of the few pennies in the colony dropped. He would build the grandest hospital the world had ever seen, and he would build it with rum. Macquarie signed a contract with Darcy Wentworth and two local entrepreneurs. They would build him a vast hospital with lots of ornamental pillars and ostentatious latticework in accordance with the eccentric designs of an unknown architect, who many believe to have been Mrs. Macquarie. He would give them 80 oxen, the use of 20 draft bullocks and 20 convict labourers, and the exclusive right to import 60,000 gallons of rum over the next 3 years. Darcy and his friends believed Macquarie was handing them the entire colonial economy on a big, shiny platter. But the builders had ignored the fine print. Exclusive didn't include shipments of rum that had already been approved, and, unbeknownst to the colonists, Britain had endorsed Macquarie's proposal to allow unlimited liquor into the colony. A merchant fleet was already on its way, carrying enough booze to knock out Keith Richards. That is, about 76,000 gallons. Macquarie also retained the right to import
what government may deem necessary for its own use and occasions.
He deemed away like there was no tomorrow, paying convicts in rum for government work. Over 120,000 gallons entered the colony, eroding the value of the hospitaller's investment. They had learned an important lesson. Never play Monopoly with a Scot. Macquarie had invested £4,200 worth of cows and convicts in the project and had taken £9,000 in spirit duties and a £40,000 hospital from the builders. This was Scottish financial management at its best. Macquarie boasted to Lord Liverpool, who had replaced Castlereagh, of his success in pulling off a public-private partnership in which the public hadn't had their privates completely screwed. Liverpool was livid. Not only had Macquarie squandered thousands of pounds on sick criminals, but funding the project with spirits was an embarrassment. Liverpool accused Macquarie of wasting money, which was the greatest insult that could be levelled at a Scot. The shattered governor assured Liverpool that there had never been
a greater economist in every branch of public expenditure than his niggardly self.
The Rum Hospital, as it was known, received its first patient 6 years after it was commissioned. Its mysterious architect had forgotten to include any toilets, so bedpans accumulated until the nurse warders opened the windows to slop their contents onto the ground below. The windows were opened infrequently because patients kept trying to escape out of them. Food was prepared in the crowded wards because the hospital's kitchen was being used as a morgue, with smoke and grease from the roaring cook fires combining with the scent of the overflowing bedpans to create a toxic miasma. Syphilis was rife, with venereal patients locked in a storeroom and the doors of the male and female wards bolted from the outside in a futile attempt to prevent patients from having sex. Nurses would throw warm meat at the ill rather than serve it on a plate, which Darcy explained was to protect them from contagion. Medicine, bandages and stockings were in short supply, as hospital staff stole them to sell on the black market. The hospital was colloquially known as the Sydney Slaughterhouse. Its interior was reminiscent of something painted by Hieronymus Bosch on one of his really bad days, but it looked great from Macquarie Street, as the governor had indulgently named the new boulevard that ran past the hospital's majestically porticoed entrance. It seems somehow fitting that this building, shiny on the outside but rotten at its core, with its disease, noxious vapours, illicit intercourse, petty theft, hurled food and excrement, and its inmates shielded from public view, now serves as New South Wales's Parliament House. Despite his love of rum, Macquarie knew the colony could not continue to run on a currency prone to spillage and evaporation. In 1813, he imported 40,000 Spanish dollars and gave them to William Henschel, a convicted coiner, with instructions to cut the centre out of each coin. Henschel established Australia's first coining mint and produced a donut-shaped coin known as the Holy Dollar, which was issued as the colony's principal currency. The disc removed from the dollar's centre, known as the dump, entered circulation as a small denomination coin. Macquarie, in a moment of Scottish fiscal genius, declared that the two new coins would have a combined value of $1.25, generating a tidy profit for his government. Macquarie's creative accounting inspired Australia's largest merchant bank, Macquarie Bank, to adopt his name and take the Holy Dollar as its logo. The bank, like its namesake, is famed for its money-spinning toll roads and other infrastructure projects. Now that people had cold, hard cash, they needed somewhere to put it. In 1817, Macquarie encouraged Darcy and others, mostly emancipists, to establish the Bank of New South Wales, Australia's first public company. The bank was to accept deposits, make loans, and print the colony's first banknotes. In the early 19th century, most banknotes were issued by banks rather than the state. In 1826, the British Parliament introduced laws to prevent banks from issuing notes valued at less than £5. This outraged the Scots, who could not dream of ever parting with so large a sum, and Scotland's greatest novelist, Sir Walter Scott, mounted a successful campaign to save the Scottish £1 note. Three private Scottish banks continue to issue their own banknotes to this day, and Scott's miserly victory continues to be celebrated by the Bank of Scotland, which includes Scott's portrait on all of its banknotes. But the Bank of New South Wales had teething problems. Most of the gentlemen of the anti-emancipist exclusive faction, which had previously loaned money at exorbitant rates, boycotted the bank, and Darcy, who played a key role in setting the bank's interest rates, undercut those rates through a dodgy loan agency he'd established. Directors were given banknotes to sign, some of which were never seen again. Francis Williams, an early manager, was regularly taken out to a club, plied with alcohol, and then asked to issue loans without security. It was finally discovered that Williams had given away £12,000 of the bank's £12,600 starting capital and had attempted to cover up the bank's impending insolvency by entering non-existent deposits in its books. But the bank survived and eventually thrived, eroding the financial services monopoly of the exclusive class and forever changing the way business was done in the colony. The real Macquarie Bank, once disparagingly referred to as the Convicts Bank, is now known as Westpac. Macquarie, Macquarie, Macquarie. At the end of Bligh's rule, the colony comprised land within a day's ride of Sydney and the convict hellholes of Newcastle and Van Diemen's Land. Listeners who are interested in banjo playing, cannibalism and genocide will be able to learn about Van Diemen's Land, now known as Tasmania, in the second volume of The Unauthorised History of Australia, True Gert. Macquarie wanted to upsize his little corner of empire, so he traipsed around the countryside, founding new settlements and naming prominent landmarks after himself or, when feeling sentimental, after his wife. The grandest street in every new town was named Macquarie Street, and the governor soon bestowed his name on rivers, hills, falls, fields, plains, a pass, an island, a mountain, a tower, a fort and a port. The kilt-clad egomaniac also named his child after himself, with young Lachlan Macquarie born during a dinner party for the colony's officers, who politely ignored Mrs. Macquarie's screams as they passed the port. Macquarie liked to lead grand exploration parties, a hangover from his Indian Army days. He explored the Hunter Valley with over 50 companions, including a band of musicians. He explored long and he explored hard, which was very tiring for his entourage, particularly the double bass player. The impenetrable Blue Mountains, with majestic peaks approaching 4,000 feet, kept the secrets of the vast western inland locked away and hidden from all. Except for the Aborigines, who crossed the mountains as easily as a settler could cross one of the colony's many Macquarie Streets. Then, in 1813, William Wentworth decided to pop over the ranges to see what was on the other side. His exploring buddies were Gregory Blaxland, one of the brothers who'd helped depose Bligh, William Lawson, the officer who'd valiantly stormed the front door of Government House during the rebellion, and four servants who weren't wealthy enough to be credited as explorers. The colony was strangely unexcited by the expedition. On the day of their departure, the Sydney Gazette ran a lead story about a drunk drowning in Sydney Harbour. On their return, the Gazette's account of their successful crossing was overshadowed by an article about a cockfight. Wentworth was philosophical about this muted response, but Blaxland bitched about Macquarie's failure to give him due credit for opening up the continent. Macquarie instead heaped praise on William Cox for building a road over the mountains, naming a river and a pass after him, which was a great honour, as geographical features not named Macquarie were in short supply. Blaxland was now incandescent with rage, but Macquarie dismissed his complaints as those of a leisure discontented drone. In Blaxland, the governor had made himself an enemy. Macquarie now selected the site for Bathurst, Australia's first inland town, and asked John Oxley to explore the interior. Oxley had been appointed Surveyor General because of his liberal education. It's amazing how far an arts degree could get you in 1812. The liberally educated Oxley spent his first 5 years in the job diligently not surveying anything. He then spent 1817 and 1818 lost in the Lachlan and Macquarie River marshlands before emerging to declare that the continent's interior was a vast inland sea. Oxley, who never forgave Macquarie for making him leave the comforts of Sydney, became the pin-up boy for future generations of inept Australian explorers. Ozymandias. New settlements required new infrastructure, which didn't worry Macquarie because he was an infrastructure kind of guy. But it very definitely worried the British Parliament, which couldn't understand why Macquarie was spending its money on new towns for criminals when Britain needed every spare penny to fund its wars against France and America. Macquarie wasn't only building new towns, he was also renovating the existing ones. When he arrived in Sydney, bark huts leaned higgledy-piggledy against mansions, men and livestock jostled for space on muddy tracks, and the colony's public buildings were in a permanent state of imminent collapse. This was an affront to Macquarie's sense of military order and his wife's sense of aesthetics, so he embarked on an ambitious policy of urban redesign. He tore down houses to straighten streets, insisted that all dwellings be fenced and numbered, decreed that bullocks should not defecate upon his shiny new footpaths, exiled the town's pigs to the newly sprouting suburbs and, to show that the colony had really arrived on the world stage, installed Australia's first flush toilet at his Parramatta weekender. The French were disgusted by the increasingly popular English custom of installing toilets in residential dwellings, which, flush notwithstanding, they regarded as unhygienic. The French derisively referred to an indoor toilet as un lieu à l'anglaise, or an English place, which is a possible origin of the term loo. Despite the repeated urgings of his political masters to curb public spending, Macquarie erected grand edifice after grand edifice, each a monument to his munificence with other people's money. He was pharaoh. He was emperor. He was the grandest of poobahs. He was Ozymandias, and all those who followed him to rule would look on his works and despair. Macquarie's grand designs were assisted by Francis Greenway, an arrogant, socially maladroit architect who believed that Sir Christopher Wren was a small-town hack, although a couple of his churches were okay. Greenway's genius had not been appreciated in Britain, and in an attempt to escape insolvency, he had forged a document, and so booked himself a one-way ticket to Sydney. Greenway impressed Macquarie with his certainty about architecture. He told Macquarie that his pride and joy, the Rum Hospital, was crap. The columns were crap, the design was crap, and Macquarie was crap for allowing it to be built. So Macquarie sent Greenway to work decrapifying Sydney. The sullen architect did up the hospital at the original builder's expense, earning the eternal enmity of Darcy Wentworth. He converted a courthouse into a church and a school into a courthouse. He constructed Gothic forts at Bennelong and Dawes Point, which were useless militarily, but looked pretty cool in a detached, brooding kind of way. He erected a miniature Greek obelisk to serve as a reference point for the colony's milestones, and a not-so-miniature Greek temple to serve as a water pump for thirsty soldiers. He was thwarted in his desire to include a giant frieze as a tribute to the winds in his neoclassical lighthouse at South Head, which included a domed room for the governor's pleasure, but insufficient space for the troops to be stationed there. The lighthouse he built at Newcastle inexplicably took the form of a Chinese pagoda. Macquarie's critics labelled his 265 public works extravagances and fugacious toys, but the governor claimed they were necessary to soak up the colony's excess labour. In 1815, Napoleon reverted to type. At Waterloo, Napoleon did surrender. In the 6 years after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, the population of New South Wales doubled. All the criminals who had been asked to stand patiently in front of French cannons could now build pretty things for Macquarie. Shit happens. The progressive settlement of New South Wales was proving unsettling for the first Australians. Some of those who had been moved off their lands hooked up with foreign tribes who dwelled at the fringe of the white man's reach. Others, like Bungaree, moved into the towns. Bungaree, who had circumnavigated Australia with Flinders and Trim, would paddle out to welcome incoming ships wearing mismatched sailors' clothes and a faux admiral's hat. The King of Port Jackson, as he was known, greeted Macquarie and other new arrivals with a wacky native routine that he had discovered earned him laughs, free food, and the occasional coin. Macquarie regarded Bungaree as a prototype from which he might design a new, improved Aborigine. Bungaree was amiable and pleasantly subservient, and his willingness to pander to a stereotype reinforced the colonists' feelings of comfortable superiority. He was a much better role model for his people than the brooding Bennelong, who was, quite frankly, a bit of a downer. Bennelong had hit the bottle and moved into the garden of his friend James Squire, Australia's first brewer. Or James Squire and his garden had moved into Bennelong's camp. It's all a matter of perspective. Bennelong died on the Squire's estate in 1813, his affection unconciliated. His obituary in the Sydney Gazette illustrated the transformation of the Aborigine in the colonial mind from noble to ungrateful savage. Of this veteran champion of the native tribe, little favourable can be said. His voyage and benevolent treatment in Britain produced no change whatever in his manner and inclinations, which were naturally barbarous and ferocious. Macquarie wanted to be friends with the Aborigines. Macquarie even invited Aborigines to his son's birthday parties, although not to the ones that other people were invited to. Lachlan Jr. loved birthday segregation because he got two sets of presents. He particularly liked the dead birds given to him at his Aboriginal parties, although Government House guests complained about the smell of his collection of badly stuffed parrots. Macquarie believed that he could make an, in some degree, useful people out of Bungaree's stock if he could overcome their
great indolence.
He was concerned that Aborigines' lives were wasted in wandering through their native woods when they might work as labourers in agricultural employ or among the lower classes of mechanics. So he established the Native Institution. The institution was devoted to the
civilisation of the Aborigines of both sexes.
It took in children aged 4 to 7 and taught them reading, writing, arithmetic and other branches of the learning tree, including agriculture for boys and needlework for girls. Macquarie, who promised graduates exciting career opportunities in the dynamic hoeing and sewing industries, ordered
that no child, after having been admitted into the institution, shall be permitted to leave it or be taken away by any person whatever, whether parents or other relatives, until such time as the boy shall have attained the age of 16 years and the girls 14 years.
The governor hoped that this borrowed generation would renounce their tribal ways, marry each other, and set up on small acreages, supervised by white managers in Blackstown, now the Sydney suburb of Blacktown, a small settlement he had established just for them. His dreams were imperfectly realised, as neither parents nor children had understood the borrowed bit, and most students ran away before they could be properly civilised. Macquarie also experimented on Bungaree, giving him a lovely brass plate to hang around his neck, inscribed with the words, Bungaree, Chief of the Broken Bay Tribe, a tribe and position that Macquarie had entirely made up. The governor then exiled the Bungaree family to a model farm on George's Head. Bungaree didn't see the need to spend all day tilling the earth when he could be bobbing about on the harbour, so the farming experiment failed. Macquarie further attempted to build relationships with his new neighbours by holding an annual state-sponsored corroboree, at which he would distribute trousers, blankets and brass nameplates and confer orders of merit on well-behaved tribal leaders. He thought everyone was getting along famously until Appin happened. Three soldiers patrolling the Nepean shot at some Aborigines raiding a cornfield and killed a boy. The Aborigines speared one of the soldiers and left his mutilated body to be found by his companions. A revenge party marched out and killed an Aboriginal woman and three children. Payback raids killed a number of settlers. The violence escalated. On 10 April 1816, Macquarie sent out the troops to inflict terrible and exemplary punishments on the hostile tribes. Any Aborigines found were to be taken prisoner, with those refusing to surrender to be fired upon. The bodies of those killed were to be hanged in trees in order to strike the greater terror into the survivors, and the soldiers were to bring in 18 good-looking children for the native institution, which was having problems with enrolments. Captain John Wallace found a recently abandoned campsite in the bush near Appin and, hearing a baby's cry, ordered his men to give chase. They shot at least 14 Gandangara, mostly old men, women and children. An unknown number of Gandangara threw themselves off a 60-metre cliff in a frantic effort to escape the soldiers and their dogs. Three dead warriors were beheaded, their bodies left to hang in trees and their heads posted to a venerable Scottish educational institution. From a governor whose inaugural speech had emphasised that Aborigines were to be treated with kindness and attention, this was hardcore stuff. Macquarie proceeded to kindly and attentively pass laws preventing Aborigines from carrying weapons near settlements or gathering in groups of more than six. Peaceful Aborigines could apply for passports, which they could show to colonists who wanted to shoot them. Unfortunately, a passport doesn't have the same range as a musket. An amnesty was finally declared in December 1816, after which Macquarie increased his efforts to Christianise the wayward natives, whom Marsden had refused to minister to on the grounds that
commerce promotes industry, industry civilisation, and civilisation opens up the way for the gospel.
Marsden's belief that only people interested in buying and selling things could be Christians meant that the Aborigines were spared organised religious instruction until the first missionary arrived in Australia in 1821. The Reverend William Walker, a dour Wesleyan, wasted no time in advising the Aborigines that they were the descendants of Ham, the son of Noah whom God had cursed with blackness and condemned to be a servant of servants to his brothers, who were a nice pink colour. Judge Baron Field, a founder for the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge among the Aborigines, mused of his charges,
"Perhaps it is better that their name should pass away from this earth."
Field's belief in the Aboriginal people's inevitable extinction was embraced by policymakers for the next century. With friends like Macquarie, Field and Walker, the Aborigines didn't need enemies. The Pipe of Moll. There were many bitter opponents to Macquarie's rule, but surprisingly, his problems started with his own regiment, whose officers were outraged that Macquarie expected them to break bread with ex-criminals at Government House dinners. Lieutenant McNaughton was so affronted that he rose from the governor's table in protest. McNaughton was not, however, opposed to being in the company of convicts in the bedroom. He aggressively pursued one of the colony's many seamstresses and, when a man tried to intervene, beat him to death with a fence piling. McNaughton became one of the convicts he so despised, but to Macquarie's fury received only 6 months' jail for manslaughter at court-martial. The governor wrote to the new colonial secretary, Lord Bathurst, seeking an end to officers judging their peers and requesting the recall of the Black Watch. It was Macquarie's willingness to go against his own that, more than anything else, endeared him to the emancipist and convict classes. The watch departed in 1814, replaced by the 46th Regiment and its commandant, George Mull, a friend from Macquarie's Indian Army days. However, the governor soon fell out with his old war buddy, who appeared to want to scrape something off the bottom of his shoe every time he saw an emancipist. Matters came to a head when a pipe was published against Mull. Pipes were anonymous defamatory writings, commonly written in verse. They were called pipes because the paper on which they were written was rolled into a pipe and inserted into a gap in a wall where it could be found by passers-by. Piping was the trolling of the pre-Facebook era. The mocking verse accused Mull of publicly crawling to Macquarie while backstabbing him, and of being a fat, money-grubbing, anti-emancipist bigot and drunken lech who couldn't tell a proper joke. It ended with the words, "And now farewell, thou dirty, grovelling mole. Go with thy namesake, burrow in thy hole." The colony's officers offered a £100 reward for the capture of the offending poet, which only served to excite public interest in the pipe and the publication of additional copies. Mull was angered by Macquarie's lack of interest in paying the piper his due, which Mull believed to be a rope and a short, sharp drop. Around this time, William Wentworth suddenly decided he had urgent business in London. During a subsequent inquiry into the pipe, Darcy admitted William was its author. Some officers, with the support of Mull, circulated a pamphlet that wrote of the pipes, "issuing from the pens of men so much our inferiors in rank and situation, that we know them not but among that promiscuous class, which, with pride we speak it, have been ever excluded from intercourse with us." The pamphlet asked Macquarie to "approve and applaud that system of exclusion," and noted that the officers' emancipist-free mess table was "regarded as the standard of society in this colony." Macquarie was angry at this open declaration of class war, and apoplectic at the inference that his dining with emancipists was improper and discreditable. After Mull arrested Darcy for the crime of being William's father, Macquarie ordered his erstwhile friend detained until the regiment sailed for home. The brothers bent. Yet Macquarie's problems with the military were nothing compared to those with the judiciary. Ellis Bent, the colony's 26-year-old deputy judge advocate, was afflicted with constantly weeping eyes and premature baldness, ran to fat, and sweated more than an Armenian in a Turkish bathhouse. He suffered from rheumatism, and his natural tendency towards stress was exacerbated by a spirited wife who kept falling off horses. Bent loathed the colony with a fervour that bordered on the unholy. The only thing Bent loathed more than New South Wales was the house Macquarie gave him on his arrival, a perfect pigsty. Macquarie dutifully arranged for him to move into one of the grandest residences in the colony. Bent hated it. Macquarie then gave Bent money to build a combined courthouse and home. Bent built himself a stately manor with a 20-foot square ensuite court that he could barely squeeze into. Bent hated it. Bent then asked for and was granted a large amount of land, which he hated. He sold the property despite it being illegal to do so, secure in the knowledge that he would let himself off with a stern warning if summoned to appear before himself. Bent demanded that Macquarie build him another courthouse, but the obliging governor was stymied by Bathurst's order to stop wasting Britain's money building things. Bent took this personally. He told Macquarie that he had shown a great want of feeling for my attention and personal comfort, and that he did not consider it necessary to preserve even the external appearance of respect. When people rose in church at the governor's entry, Bent remained obdurately seated. He further insisted that, as a judge, he was not subject to the governor's authority, even though Macquarie's commission made it perfectly clear that he was. During happier times, Macquarie had recommended Ellis's brother, Geoffrey, for appointment as the colony's assistant judge. The cadaverous Geoffrey was even more difficult than his brother. Geoffrey was insulted that he hadn't been knighted upon his appointment and refused to disembark from his ship until Macquarie arranged a full naval salute to honour his arrival. After landing, he insisted that if the governor didn't have to pay tolls on the Parramatta Turnpike, he shouldn't either. Sir Geoffrey, as he was known behind his back, threatened to jail the toll keepers who harassed him and burn down their toll gate. Darcy Wentworth issued a fine for toll evasion, which Geoffrey said he didn't have to pay because he was a judge. He should have just said someone else was riding his horse. It took two centuries for a brave Australian judge to challenge on similar grounds the oppressive road fines imposed on the judiciary by executive government. Unfortunately, the Einfeld defence, as it has become known, has been white-anted by non-lawyers who don't properly understand the separation of powers. The Bents, who had previously employed ex-convicts to do legal work, now decided that emancipist lawyers could no longer appear in their courts. As there was a critical shortage of non-criminal criminal lawyers, the Bents closed the courts, throwing the entire justice system into chaos. By now, Macquarie had had enough and told Bathurst that if the Bents didn't leave the colony, then he would. Ellis made things easier by dying, but Geoffrey escalated hostilities, claiming that Macquarie had murdered his brother by providing him with substandard accommodation. Bathurst finally sacked Geoffrey, who had moved in with Ellis's widow and her horses, and had to be formally evicted from the housing he had long decried. The homeless judge returned to London to campaign for Macquarie's recall and his own appointment as governor. He was instead appointed Chief Justice of Granada, but was soon suspended from that position, with Granada's governor writing, "Peace and tranquillity can never be restored to this once happy and united colony, while Mr. Bent is suffered to preside on the bench of justice." Of unlibraries and unlobsters. Samuel Marsden admired the governor's efforts to curb immorality. Macquarie had outlawed nude bathing and, as part of a package of tough Sabbath-breaking laws, prohibited shooting a neighbour's dog on a Sunday. Macquarie, determined to check the scandalous and pernicious custom so generally and shamelessly adopted throughout the territory of persons of different sexes cohabiting and living together, unsanctioned by the legal ties of matrimony, introduced laws to prevent unmarried women from inheriting their partner's property. Marriage rates skyrocketed. George Johnston, who had quietly slipped back into the colony, finally tied the knot with Esther Abrahams after 27 years of scandalous perniciousness. But governor and churchmen soon fell out over their radically different answers to the emancipist question. Marsden refused to serve as a turnpike commissioner with Thompson and Lord, as associating with ex-convicts would be a degradation of my sacred office. Macquarie, in turn, came to regard the preacher as filled with hypocritical religious cant. Marsden had raised public funds in England for a lending library for the general benefit of the inhabitants of New South Wales. The 450 books he purchased included numerous Bibles, 6 sermons on original sin, 12 sermons on the torments of hell, and over 100 tracts for unhappy women, drunkards, swearers, and Sabbath breakers. There were also lots of books about sheep. The Sydney Gazette published an anonymous satirical article pointing out that the books seemed strangely geared towards Marsden's personal interests and querying the library's public character, as it was located on Marsden's country estate, 15 miles away from any public. Marsden believed the article was written by John Campbell, the editor of the Gazette and Macquarie's loyal secretary. Campbell was later found to be the author of another satirical piece that accused Marsden of stealing from charity, gun running, and introducing the Polynesians to the art of distillation and that tiny race of animals which on being boiled do not prove to be lobsters. Marsden, who now made most of his money as a Pacific trader, successfully sued Campbell for the imputation that he got Tahitian girls drunk and gave them crabs. Believing Macquarie had sanctioned the Gazette's attacks, Marsden wrote to his patrons in Britain, accusing Macquarie of providing inadequate facilities at the female factory, thereby forcing convict women into prostitution, and condemning the Parramatta Hospital as a place of drunkenness, whoredom, sickness and death. Using his position as a magistrate, Marsden launched an investigation into Macquarie's summary flogging of 3 men who'd trespassed in the domain after hours. Macquarie had built a giant wall around the domain, but lewd, disorderly men and women kept on knocking holes in it for the most indecent, improper purposes. The governor, frustrated that his repeated orders to behave properly in Mrs. Macquarie's parklands were being ignored, decided to make a public example of the Domain 3. This resulted in a public backlash, as the men were not convicts and should not have been punished without trial. Macquarie shut down Marsden's inquiry into the flogging and told the turbulent priest he never wished to see him again unless forced to on public occasions. Macquarie's enemies were multiplying faster than Rain Man. The viper nourished. John MacArthur observed Macquarie's emancipist policies from a distance and lamented that they would still the birth of the Australian aristocracy that had long been his dream. MacArthur was not having a good time in Britain. He had become a radical vegetarian, a classic sign of mental instability, and the black dog of depression chewed at his slippers whenever he thought of all he had lost. Yet MacArthur could not return to his wife and sheep, as Castlereagh had ordered Macquarie to try him as the leading promoter and instigator of the mutinous measures if he again set foot in the colony. Bathurst was a more forgiving colonial secretary and allowed MacArthur's return after 8 years of exile on condition that he stick to farming rather than tearing down governors. Macquarie, who got on famously with Mrs. MacArthur, took the returning viper into his bosom. He politely received him at Government House, said nice things about his sheep, and was prepared to let bygones be bygones. Unfortunately, MacArthur had other ideas. The times, they are a-changin'. Back in Britain, bleeding heart liberals were advocating radical social change. There were calls to emancipate Catholics, unchain lunatics, give poor men the vote, abolish capital punishment and, much to the disgust of Sir Joseph Banks, end slavery and animal vivisection. The wheelchair-bound botanist, still president of the Royal Society and the proud owner of the British Empire's bushiest eyebrows, died of disgust at this newfangled liberalism in 1820. The social reformers, many of whom were evangelical Christians, also called for the abolition of transportation and the moral re-education of criminals in purpose-built British jails. Henry Grey Bennett MP, one of the leading reformers, regarded Macquarie as a Tory dinosaur. He railed against Macquarie's autocratic powers, his building of fopperies and follies, his preference for emancipists over free settlers, and his tolerance of moral degeneracy. Bennett, standing as a moral patriot, took a beating after he propositioned a young male servant at a Belgian health spa. Bennett took less dramatic action than his political enemy Castlereagh, instead choosing self-exile at Lake Como with the understanding Mrs. Bennett. Bathurst had already come to the view that Macquarie suffered from ill-considered compassion for convicts and wanted a scapegoat for his government's transportation policy. Macquarie was his sacrificial ungulate of choice. Bathurst commissioned John Thomas Big, a friend of the Bents, to conduct a wide-ranging inquiry into the affairs of the colony. Big was instructed to consider how transportation might once more be made an object of real terror and look into the conduct of leading citizens and officials, however exalted in rank or sacred in character, a clear license to gun for Macquarie. Big was also given extraordinary powers to make recommendations that Macquarie was compelled to implement, unless he wished to appeal to Mad King George, who was now blind and deaf as well as insane. Every waking moment of Big's 2 years in the colony was dedicated to tarnishing Macquarie's reputation. He didn't bother to conceal his agenda, starting all interviews with,
"Have you any complaint to make against Governor Macquarie?"
A conga line of suckholes queued at his door to denounce the governor, with Marsden, the Blaxlands and Oxley first in line. Big, who expressed astonishment at the useless magnificence of Macquarie's building program, even got Francis Greenway to testify against his patron. Greenway, who had previously marketed himself as the colony's architectural visionary, now claimed that he was just the builder. The two-timing architect got his comeuppance, living out his days in a bark hut in a swamp and being buried in an unmarked grave. But it was John MacArthur who played the greatest role in setting the tone of Big's three damning reports. MacArthur, while assuring Macquarie of his loyalty, criticised every aspect of his rule, testifying before Big that "Democratic feeling has already taken deep root in the colony in consequence of the absurd and mischievous policy pursued by Governor Macquarie." Biggs reports condemned Macquarie's mollycoddling of convicts and emancipists, accused him of wasting Britain's money, and charged him with neglecting women and the sick. Big praised the two-faced MacArthur as an agricultural genius and endorsed his vision for the colony as a feudal aristocracy of men of real capital who would produce wool, wool and wool to keep Britain's feet warm at night. Macquarie's resignation was finally accepted and he set sail for Britain in 1822 with a shipload of kangaroos for his friends and patrons. Tourists now take toy kangaroos home with them after visiting Australia. Visitors in Macquarie's day, unencumbered by ridiculous quarantine and animal welfare laws, took home the real thing. Macquarie loved kangaroos, probably because they are among the only animals in the world to have inbuilt sporans. Cheering well-wishers farewelled Macquarie from the docks. However unpopular Bennett and Big had made him back in Britain, he remained a crowd favourite down under. About that spare penny. Macquarie returned to Britain to find himself £500 in debt and under attack from the British Treasury, which couldn't find the receipts for his £10,000 worth of holy dollars and was demanding that he pay for them out of his own pocket. The proud Scot's dreams of living out his days on a comfortable estate were dust. He retired to a tiny leaking house without even a room of his own. Macquarie didn't much mind his reduced standard of living, as it was traditional for wealthy Scots to live in small windowless hovels subsisting entirely on porridge and sheep offal. However, he deeply resented not having any money to not spend. Macquarie dedicated the remainder of his life to asking for a pension and rebutting the claims made by Big. Although he was politely shunned by MPs in public, his achievements had earned their private respect. Castlereagh, only days before his suicide, took Macquarie to visit the new king. Macquarie paid his respects to the Viscount's widow shortly after the letter opener incident, writing, "She does not appear to suffer from affliction from the death of her good amiable lord. She has grown amazingly fat and appears very gay." This was insensitive, as appearing very gay was the cause of Castlereagh's untimely death. Amazingly fat people are also likely to be offended by Macquarie's poor choice of words. Bathurst commended Macquarie for his able and successful administration, although he refused to speak these words on the record, and finally gave the ex-governor a generous pension. Macquarie did not live to enjoy his golden handshake. He died 5 weeks later, his passing mourned by a distant people who did not yet know who they were, but whose hearts moved to a beat that was no longer entirely British. In 1824, the year of Macquarie's death, the old men who sat in the shadowed halls of Westminster dusted off the recommendation Macquarie had made 7 years earlier and gave a new name to the land he had come to call home. Australia. Girt by sea.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.